a great chance you should be thrilled.
Thrilled? There could be a death penalty.
Not for the lawyer.
Seriously, when the going gets tough, you don't want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer.
Ladytrons and Gentlebots.
Objection. In the absence of pants, defense and suspenders serve no purpose.
I'm going to allow them for now.
Thank you.
I may be a simple country apple chicken, but I know when we're finger-licked. What do you say we plead insanity?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 27. I'm Thomas Smith, and how are you doing, Andrew Torres?
I am fantastic. I am allergy-free. How are you?
You son of a bitch. I'm a little reference to my Claritin D tweeted about. Anyway, inside joke. I'm doing great for a multitude of reasons. For one, check out Andrew on episode 300 of Atheistically Speaking coming at you soon. Actually, that one will be Thursday. I want to thank Andrew for coming on. It was lots of fun. And also, I am so excited by the answers we got for Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. That was good. That was okay. So here's the thing. This bit was a good idea. I knew it was a good idea. I knew it was going to be fun. It felt fun when we were doing it. Andrew and I were excited about it. And then Andrew selected the winning answer from last week's question. And it's even better than I ever could have hoped anything would ever be. It is so magical. I'm excited. So I'm pumped. How about you? You excited? You feeling good?
I am very excited. So let's get into that. You took question one on Thomas.
Yeah, are you keeping my stats?
Exam.
You got your, a clipboard?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is right. Because remember, the bar exam is pass-fail, and no associate has ever failed the bar exam at this firm.
Yeah, I'm particularly worried about that. It's very intimidating to know that no one here at Covington Burlington Code Factory has ever not passed. So let's look at the results, shall we? What do you think?
Yeah. So you remember this question involved a property owner selling a piece of property to his neighbor for $200,000. The owner wrote out an agreement and signed it. The neighbor presented the $200,000, but did not sign the agreement. And then the property owner, upon being handed the $200,000 check, said, "No, I don't like these terms after all.
The neighbor had never signed it, right? Did you say? I think you missed that. Yeah.
Okay. Correct. Correct.
So that was the question. So what was it going to stand up, basically?
Right. And so as is the case for the actual bar exam, you have to not only pick, does the agreement stand up, but you have to pick why. So we had four answers. We had A, no, because the neighbor did not expressly state that he accepted the agreement. B, no, because the neighbor had to put his signature on the document to make it a binding contract. And I would say on an informal basis, we had all four answers were submitted to us by listeners. I would say B is probably the most popular answer. No. He didn't sign it, not a binding contract.
Makes sense. It's the intuitive answer, that I would say.
Yeah. Thomas went with C, yes, because the neighbor manifested his assent by his conduct of tendering the full sale price, at which point a contract existed. And then D was yes, because the property owner created a binding contract when he prepared an agreement containing the agreed terms, which I believe you thought was the most foolish of the answers. But nevertheless, got a couple of nibbles from the audience. So the answer is C.
Yes, I got it right. I'm in disbelief. I can't. Wow, that's incredible. I got it right.
So Yeah, we're going to keep track of your score. You got the first one correct. You are one for one with 199 questions to go. Yeah, I like this question because it shows a couple of different things about the bar. And one thing that I think is pretty common to opening arguments, right, which is to say a signature on a contract certainly helps when you are attempting to explain and prove in court that the parties agreed to things, right? Like, so if your signature is on something, it's very, very difficult for you to argue that you didn't agree to it. But a signature isn't magic. And lots of times business gets done and people don't sign agreements for lots of reasons, right? Like you start performing and it's assumed that eventually you're going to sign it. Or I have litigated and I have seen a lot of these kinds of cases where, you know, what you have is something less than kind of the ideal perfect situation.
So is this a way to kind of get away from a gotcha thing where it's like, well, we can start the contract, but I didn't technically sign it, but I'm kind of like, oh, I will sign it. And then I get some services or something and then I try to go back on it. So the law is saying, well, there are other ways you can show that you agree to a contract besides just signing. Is that what's happening, basically?
That's exactly right. And when I give you, if you say, hey, give me $200,000 and I'll give you this piece of property, and I give you the $200,000, right? That is
a sign that you are agreeing,
terms of the question. Yeah. That is assent. Yeah, that says, look, yeah, I agree. So a contract is created when one party makes an offer. That offer is supported by consideration, which is to say something of value, and the other party agrees to the terms. And so once that happens, the contract is completed. There are a couple of interesting distractors with listeners who wanted to talk about the statute of frauds, which is a doctrine regarding contracts that cannot be completed in a certain period of time. But tendering the real estate here is just, this is a garden variety contract. Don't get distracted by anything else. There was an offer, 200 grand. There was consideration, which is the actual money and the property. And there was acceptance, which was manifested by the
and
neighbor.
And since I got it
money.
Right, I can pretend I knew all that, basically. That's how multiple choice works. Yeah.
So you got it right. And Thomas, I believe you had some thoughts on
some
of our
suggested
listeners.
Well, we've got to shout out to Nicholas Alkoff, who Andrew noted wrote a 10-paragraph, 900-word response, screenshot it and attached it to Twitter. Now, that's okay. If you quote and tweet, as long as it's quoted and retweeted, you can respond in a screenshot thing or whatever. But he guessed C, then A, then B. That's a very lawyery thing to do, I feel like. It's covering your ass. Okay, good. But now we've got to talk about the greatest answer. This was such a good answer. I can't believe it. At Godless Steve said, C, because on To Catch a Predator, the pedo who brings a burger after being asked to helps show intent and strengthens the case against him. It is so great because it's the right answer. And that reasoning, it kind of applies, right? Like, isn't it sort of the same thing? If they were asked to bring a burger to, you know, on this date that he's going on and he does, you know, that helps show that he intended to, you know, he assented to the contract they were forming. I don't know. It's kind of close.
Yeah, there's no contract of showing up at a house with an informer pretending to be a 14-year-old
girl.
But
it does. But the principle behind that bolstering the case is got to be similar to the principle behind showing up with the $200,000 showing you agree. I mean, it's a similar thing.
In the farthest extremes, the idea that you can say yes without saying yes, I will accept that part of the answer. Either way, it's a fantastic
answer.
We totally agree.
Thank
this
you,
was a
Godless
fantastic
Steve.
Answer.
You're the winner. Lots of people got it right. Lots of people guessed every single answer, which is good. but that was a success. I consider that. Godless Steve, I don't know how you're going to live up to that one. We'll see what television show reference he pulls out next. But thanks for that. And yeah, I think that's it. So look forward to the next question will be at the end of this episode. That'll be question two. And we'll see if I do that. Because if I miss that one, I mean, I'm at 50%, you know, and there's what threshold is pass fail? What threshold do I have to get to pass?
I will look. It changes from year to year.
Oh, is it a curve?
And so The other thing is there's a component of both the multi-state and the essay exams, which obviously that would be some fantastic
Thomas
radio.
Thomas takes the essay exam portion of the bar.
Thomas writes a two-hour legal essay
just
on the
scribbling
air.
Like, and like, no, gosh, dang it.
It'll just be the sounds of your pen scratching. It will be outstanding.
Yeah, we probably won't do that one. Let's pretend I aced that.
Yeah.
Give me a ballpark. What do I need to roughly get? I mean, what, 75%?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite that high. I think you need, assuming that you wrote great essays, and we're going to assume that.
We already did that portion on an earlier show, and I passed with flying colors.
Yeah, I think you can get in the 130s. I could be wrong about that.
130s?
It's been a long time.
Out of 200.
Out of 200 questions.
Okay, so we'll go for 65%. We'll shoot for that. Okay.
I will look. Before our next episode, I will look and see.
Because if I do pass, when we get 200 episodes from now, when I do pass, I do expect some sort of ceremony from you. Some sort of, I don't know
what. Obviously.
On the show, too. I want to be recognized.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll be admitted to the bar on. Oh wait, like I can practice law just on this podcast. That'll be what. Not in any state, but just like floating in the podcast sphere. That's the only place I can practice. If
yeah,
I pass.
And you can continue to hold yourself out as Thomas Smith Esquire.
Of course. Okay. Right. So let's get on to our. Well, oh no, I guess we have a non-segment thing to talk about first, right? This goes in the category of. Andrew Torres is pretty much always right. The reason that, I'm very proud to be on a show with him. Michigan recount stopped after judge says Jill Stein has no legal standing. We've gotten a lot of email about this, comments about this. And before this, you've got a bunch of questions. It's like, hey, there is a recount going in Michigan. You know, a-hole, you were wrong, right? Have you got a few of those?
Not only did I get that, I'm not kidding about this. I had 11,000 people reply vote angry on a Facebook post before I got kicked off of a
11,000?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, this
Thanksgiving
is that lawyer
night.
Group.
Yeah,
thing.
I was added to a liberal lawyers private Facebook group by one of our listeners, and I'm not sure whether I appreciate this or not. who had, essentially posted our take. Right. And she was not a lawyer. And so she said, all right, well, I'm going to bring in the lawyer who said this. And I was tagged in and I was kicked from the group in about half an hour.
Wow.
Which was
for being right. Damn it.
Look, I mean, one of the things I've said this elsewhere, we're trying to help people understand news stories that may be inaccurately or failing to cover legal issues in current topics. And, look, sometimes the law isn't clear, but to the best of our ability, like we're going to try and take a stand and, and we're going to try and be accountable too, right? Like, I mean, if this recount had gone forward, there's no place for me to hide, right? I mean, I made my opinion really, really clear.
It would just be all bar exam questions after that. Yeah, right. We'd be like, I didn't have time to admit Andrew was totally full of crap.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, I I'm going to get stuff wrong because everybody gets stuff wrong, but,
but not this.
You and I are skeptics, and we believe in being held accountable. So
absolutely, and this is the kind of thing where, there was a lot of the stuff you call out, and I can't really include myself, mainly you, but I try is right wing bias, Scalia and his terrible decisions that he made when he thought he was interpreting, reading some chicken bones and telling what the founders. Wanted to do. But this is a case of, left-wing bias. People really wanted something to be true, and and it wasn't. I argued with people who really were not receptive to our opinions on this at all, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I take pride that this week alone I have been called a left-wing shill by a Trump supporter who refused to listen to OA13. I mean, this is somebody who is still going around chanting "lock her up," and one of our listeners was like, maybe you should listen to Opening Arguments 13, and you'll come." And he was like, "I'm not listening to some Hillary shill," and whatever. And I was called a Trump shill by about 11,000 Jill Stein supporters. I like to think we're pretty open, right? I mean, we say where our biases are politically, right? We're left of center. We're out there and in front about it, but we're going to try and give you the actual facts to the best of our abilities. And I think
so.
If
enough
called out
praising
by,
ourselves. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's all true. But so what happened? Yeah. I mean, is it? Do we even need to get into it? The judge pretty much said what you said, right?
Yeah. I mean,
case closed.
If you look at the article, which I will link in the show notes, here is the gravamen of the judge opinion. U.S. District Judge Mark Goldsmith agreed with the Republicans, who argued that the 3-day recount must end a day after the state appeals court dealt a blow to the effort. Stein, who finished fourth in Michigan on November the 8th, did not have a chance of winning even after a recount and therefore isn't an, quote, aggrieved candidate, the appeals court said. And now,
boy,
quoting
that
directly,
sounds just
from
like
Maroon,
what
yeah.
you said. Weird. Yeah.
Because
sorry,
there is no basis.
Yeah. We're going to be wrong at some
for
point.
For this court to ignore the Michigan court's ruling and make an independent judgment regarding what the Michigan legislature intended by the term aggrieved, plaintiffs have not shown an entitlement to a recount. This was what we flagged from that day before Thanksgiving vegetable chopping evening. It's really, it continues to be illustrative of the point that we make on the show all the time, which is the law is not an arcane series of traps and minefields that you have to like say the magic words to cross. And you apply a little bit of common sense. And in this case, literally everybody that I talked to who had no opinion on the subject was like, yeah, it seems kind of weird that Jill Stein would be the one bringing the recount if she's not the one who can win after a recount. And, it's really not more complicated than that, right? You wrap it in the language of aggrieved and you say aggrieved means that the court must be able to provide a remedy that solves the wrong of which you are complaining. And you can go back and ask that question. But at the end of the day, there's that common sense intuition really can hold.
All right.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
All right, let's get to our listener question for the day. Patron Paul. Oh, that's an interesting first name. Patron Paul, I have a question about abortion in the Supreme Court. Say the Supreme Court got a conservative majority and they ended up overturning Roe versus Wade. What happens regarding historical abortions? Presumably, many states still have abortion laws in their books. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, does that reinstate those laws retrospectively? Now, that's an interesting nuance because I thought he was going one way. At first, I thought he was asking, like, what about someone who already got an abortion? Would they then be, like, punished or something? And I think that the obvious answer would be no to that, right? That's never the case usually. But his question, I think, is a little more nuanced, which is these laws that were overturned at the time by the Supreme Court ruling, do they just instantly go back in effect? Or would states have to write new laws after this ruling?
Yeah, you have analyzed this exactly correctly. So let's answer the first part of the question, right, in which you get it correct, which is anybody who's had an abortion in the past, even if a new law were passed or reinstated, and I'm going to speak to that in a second, would have a defense, which is to say that they were acting under color of law. Right. So when the courts say you are entitled to do X, right, which Roe v. Wade has said for the last 43 years, that women, let's say this is a standard first trimester abortion, which is 99% of the abortions in this country, that she would be acting under color of law and would have a defense to any kind of statute that might, retroactively apply. So whenever a court says you can do something, you can proceed to that with confidence, even if you think there might be a conflicting law that could potentially stop you. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second question, when those laws were struck down by Roe v. Wade, they are struck down. And so they do not automatically spring back into existence if Roe v. Wade is overturned. You would have to pass new laws by the legislature. Kind of related to that, there is a constitutional prohibition on what are called ex post facto laws, right? So laws that criminalize that behavior prospectively. It applies after the date that the law is passed or mm-hmm. some effective date that's in the legislation. Oftentimes, laws will have kind of a lead-in time period, you know, to sort of get you prepared right. for the fact that the law is going to change. But they can't, when it is restricting your liberty, they can't look back. There are certain instances where you could have a law that expands your liberty that does in fact look back, right? So for example, imagine that a state, California, right, decides that they are going to fully legalize marijuana, right? The state could then decide and would have the option of legalizing marijuana from this point forward. Alternatively, legalizing marijuana and invalidating the convictions of anybody in state prison for possession or possession with intent to distribute of marijuana, right? So they would be able to choose. So ex post facto means law can't retroactively prohibit certain behaviors, but you can retroactively forgive certain behaviors. So right. I like the question and it ties in on abortion. So I thought it was a good one to answer.
Yeah. Yeah, and not necessarily. I mean, when you explain it, it does seem like that would be the obviously right answer, but I didn't necessarily know that ahead of time. That was an excellent question. All right, let's get to our main topic for the day, and that is the abortion, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and this is going to be part one. Now, this is something you've alluded to. This was going to be the next steps.
Yeah, and so if you remember back to our last abortion episode at the end of opening arguments number 11, if you have not listened to opening arguments 9 through 11, download those, go listen to those, put this on pause, go listen to that. It's like 3 hours of goodness. And at the end of that, I asked you, Thomas, a question from a strategic perspective, which you might remember. Right. So
Thomas takes the bar exam, the original version.
So Roe v. Wade was a 7-2 decision in 1973. We are now almost 20 years later. We are in 1992. And the court, because we have had an almost uninterrupted run of Republican presidents, the Supreme Court has shifted rather drastically from Roe v. Wade. So of the 7-2 initial allocation of the votes on the court, here's where it stands in 1992. The two dissenters from Roe v. Wade are William Rehnquist and Byron Wizard-White. Okay, they're still on the court. And in fact, William Rehnquist is now Chief Justice. Of the 7 justice majority, only Harry Blackmun, who wrote Roe, is still on the court. And the other known vote, consistent vote in favor of abortion rights over the last 20 years is John Paul Stevens, very, very liberal. He's about 105 at the time that this case comes up. So you have two strong pro-Roe advocates. You have two justices who dissented from Roe. And then the question is, who are the other 5 justices on the court? And as it turns out, the other 5 justices on the court are all Republican nominees. Okay. Those are our friend Antonin Scalia, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, Clarence Thomas, who was appointed by George H.W. Bush, Sandra Day O'Connor, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, Anthony Kennedy, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and David Souter, who was appointed by George H.W. Bush. So
very Republican.
Yeah. So there's your lineup. And I asked you the strategic question. Pennsylvania has several abortion laws that restrict but do not ban abortion. And if you recall, the holding of Roe was a trimester-based approach that said, in order to balance the state's interest in the potential future life of the fetus and the state's interest in protecting the woman's liberty to choose her medical procedures, there would be a trimester approach. And that is that the state could not touch abortion in the first trimester, could restrict but not prohibit abortion in the second trimester, and could prohibit in the third trimester.
Right.
Since that's pretty clear, in the intervening 20 years, you had a lot of activism by pro-life individuals. This is pretty common, and it's actually
still goes on today, right?
Yeah, and look, yeah. Like when we talk about, you know, what's going to happen under a Trump Supreme Court, right? Like looking at, so on the left, looking at what the right did, you know, after the Supreme Court decided Roe v. Wade, was, you know, to look at the decision and see, okay, what can we do to agitate around this? And so one of the things, for example, was to come up with restrictions on the right to abortion that were nevertheless not directed at the procedure itself, right? So for example, in Pennsylvania, you have, I'm gonna say that there are four or five statutes that are actually at issue, but the key ones are a provision that requires a 24-hour waiting period. Mm-hmm. And related to that is it's 24 hours and you get some information about the complications,
right,
of
pamphlets or something.
Right. So law number one, 24-hour waiting period plus pamphlets, right? And you can see how that's a slight deterrence. Mm-hmm. Law number two required women who were under the age of 18 to have parental consent, okay?
Right.
And law number three required women of any age who were married to have spousal consent, right, mm-hmm. of the husband and father before seeking an abortion. And you can see how none of those laws prohibit a woman from having an abortion. And so so they took effect without kind of outside the trimester framework. Then my question to you at the end of OA 11 was, knowing what you know about the makeup of the Supreme Court, you can bring this in one of two ways. You can either narrowly try and defend the statutes, or you can say, you know what, it's time to go up to the Supreme Court and get this terrible Roe v. Wade decision overturned, and let's go big or go home. I don't know if you remember the choice that you made.
I thought I said, with that kind of Supreme Court going on, why not go big? Why not go for it all?
That is exactly what you decided. And by the way, it is exactly what the state of Pennsylvania decided to do.
Mm.
They said, we want to present the argument that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. And so the resulting decision, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, became about whether Roe v. Wade would survive or whether the conservative court would overturn Roe versus Wade. And unlike last time where we sort of did some storytelling, I think you know the punchline here because that was 24 years ago.
Roe v. Wade is no longer law.
Right.
Yeah.
And
no, it is law.
So here's what happened.
Well, that's already interesting to think about because it certainly makes me feel a little better when people are talking about Roe v. Wade coming down now. If that kind of court with those nominees didn't do it, then I guess I feel a tiny bit better about right now, or at least in the coming years when Trump replaces some justices. So
that's exactly,
that's interesting to think about.
That's exactly why I wanted to do this right now.
Mm.
So one of the things that's interesting about Planned Parenthood versus Casey is we have talked about Supreme Court cases from a majority-minority standpoint, 5-4, 6-3, 7-2, with our current Justice Supreme Court, you know, 6-2 or whatever. And people have become aware of the fact that the court can split 4-4, in which case the lower court ruling remains intact. We've talked about that in a previous episode. But as it turns out, because of the way in which the court is composed, you can have a case which has no majority holding. And the way in which that happens, so I want you to imagine this case has never happened, as far as I know, which is imagine all nine justices write a separate opinion. They all want to reach a different result. Okay.
Hmm.
Well, that would be 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1.
I've never thought about that. Right. So it's not a binary thing.
Yeah. Well, think about
it. Different.
You're going to take you've taken one bar exam question. You're going to take a second one at the end of this episode, right? You know that it's not just enough in the law, particularly at the Supreme Court, to say yes or no. You have to say yes because or no because.
Wait a minute. Have these justices taken the bar exam? Do they know about this?
They might. Right.
Okay.
So now you could deadlock a court, right? 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1. Right.
Oh wow.
Right. That's never happened. That's never going to happen. But but work with me on the example. Now take one of the justices and have him defect. And so now you get a two-justice plurality with seven dissents.
Yeah. Okay.
And what you have in Planned Parenthood versus Casey is you have a three-justice plurality that is the central core of the opinion. I'm going to read how it breaks down, and that's not going to make any sense, so I'm going to try and further explain it. But let me read it first, okay? Justice O'Connor, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Souter announced the judgment of the court and delivered the opinion of the court with respect to parts 1, 2, 5A, 5C, and 6. An opinion with respect to part 5E, in which Justice Stevens joins, and an opinion with respect to parts 4, 5B, and 5D.
This is all nonsense so far, yeah.
So basically, three judges wrote a six-part opinion. Of that, different judges joined in different parts of that plurality opinion, but only three judges voted for the plurality opinion. So they didn't get five, they didn't get four. The most you got on any aspect was three. But okay, all of the other dissents were not sufficient. Nobody got a five on any of the other dissents. So the net result was, because there are five votes with respect to parts of the plurality, that the whole of the three-judge plurality is considered the controlling opinion with respect to precedent. So it's really, really weird. It's not something I would have tried to explain other than the fact that this is one of the most important contemporary cases.
Yeah.
And so it's a weird process.
It didn't get a majority, but it still is...
It's the law.
Hmm.
So it's the controlling
opinion. Okay, so that doesn't kick it back down to the lower court?
Nope.
Oh, so you don't need five justices.
Yeah, okay. Remember—
You just need a majority decision.
You can have my— it's a plurality if it's less than five, right? But you can have my
plurality, yeah.
You can have my two to one, which again has never happened. But this is as close as you get.
That is so crazy.
So what did the plurality hold? Let's start at the very beginning of part one. Liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt. Yet 19 years after our holding that the Constitution protects a woman's right to terminate her pregnancy in its early stages, Roe v. Wade, that definition of liberty is still questioned. Joining the respondents as amicus curiae, the United States, as it has done in five other cases in the last decade, again asks us to overrule Roe. So that sort of sets this out. And you have this plurality opinion is written by two centrist judges, O'Connor and Kennedy, and Souter, who was a Republican appointee who started off as a centrist and became a liberal. So kind of at the core of this was the go big or go home question, right? Which is, okay, we are being asked by the Solicitor General of the United States, Ken Starr, who you may recall from some later fame, as well as the state of Pennsylvania, to overrule Roe versus Wade. But, and here's what the plurality goes on to say, after considering the fundamental constitutional questions resolved by Roe, principles of institutional integrity, and the rule of stare decisis, which we talked about in the last episode, we are led to conclude this: the essential holding of Roe v. Wade should be retained and once again affirmed. Then they say, it must be stated at the outset and with clarity that Roe's essential holding, the holding we reaffirm, has three parts. First is a recognition of the right of the woman to choose to have an abortion before viability and to obtain it without undue interference from the state. Before viability, the state's interests are not strong enough to support a prohibition of abortion or the imposition of a substantial obstacle to the woman's effective right to elect the procedure. Second is a confirmation of the state's power to restrict abortions after fetal viability if the law contains exceptions for pregnancies which endanger the woman's life or health. And third is the principle that the state has legitimate interest from the outset of the pregnancy in protecting the health of the woman and the life of the fetus that may become a child. These principles do not contradict one another, and we adhere to each. So there's some important stuff in each of those three holdings. The most important one, what Casey does is substitute the trimester approach set out in Roe for a viability test, right? And they say—
I was wondering about that. Okay.
Yeah. And so essentially, like, they say, well, look, the reason that the court picked trimester three is because that's when the fetus becomes viable. The difference between 1973 and 1992 from a medical standpoint is viability has become much, much earlier. And so now, you know, you have instead of a pretty clear fixed right, trimester one, trimester two, trimester three, you now have the state can start banning abortions at the point of viability, and the point of viability, because of medical advancements, is pushed back, you know, is we're pushing that back every day. And with good reasons, right? But so you're sort of left with kind of a perverse situation where medical research, life-saving medical research, is actually restricting constitutional jurisprudence over individual rights. So that's a really important twist. And there is,
and this did switch that through. So you're saying this did kind of bait and switch that, this ruling?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And that this is a common legal tactic, which is when a judge wants to say, I am completely following the rule of the Smith decision. And by the way, that rule is this. And then they restate it in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
You know,
bastards.
That happens.
Wow.
So that's part one of the opinion. I'm going to talk about part two. And then I think we can probably tie up a few loose ends, because that's really sort of the punchline, which is to say the practical upshot of this is that the court said that the spousal consent law constituted an undue burden on abortion pre-viability.
Right.
But that the remaining laws, the 24-hour waiting period, the informed consent for minors, and the information provisions did not constitute an undue burden. So,
well, at least they did that, because I would hope that that spousal thing wasn't going to check out. Because if you think from a rights perspective, if there was a, like, let's take the Second Amendment,
right,
and they decided, you know, well, it's okay for you to buy a gun, just get permission from your spouse. You'd be like, well, it's not really a right then. You have to get somebody else's permission for it.
You know, but I would point out that this plurality opinion was authored by, and you know, we think of Kennedy as a swing justice today, and he is, and he's moving to the left. But he was not a particularly liberal justice at the time that this was written. So Sandra Day O'Connor, very famous centrist justice, but, you know, center right. I wonder, in an alternate universe, if you had taken and Ken Starr had taken the go small approach, if they could have persuaded a court to uphold even the spousal permission statute, if they had not made the essential case about should you overturn Roe or not. And I would point out, we're going to talk a little bit about it, that the analysis, you saw the top line, but the core of the analysis for why these three centrist to, you know, center right judges decided to uphold Roe was the principle of stare decisis, right? They looked at it and they said, hey, look, it's been 20 years. Everybody
was
knows
Scalia
what the law is.
Was confused when they used that term? Was he like, hold on, guys, what is this?
I can read you some.
You need to find that for me?
Yeah, I can read you some fun Scalia stuff from this opinion. but right. I mean, the court said, you know, we talked about this in the last episode, but the court said, hey, look, there is value in predictability. For the past 20 years, we know what the law is. It has worked. Our cases have reaffirmed that holding. And we don't see the reason to overturn that holding and depart from stare decisis. We cannot say that Roe v. Wade was so wrongly decided that we need to do that. And that I think this is just a really, really good illustration of that principle from judges who, you know, were not, like I said, I mean, they upheld, you know, the more restrictive, you know, the parental consent and the waiting period and everything else. I mean, these are not judges who are pro-choice in their daily lives, but they really felt like, you know, this was the judicial minimal approach. So this is, in my view, you know, we talked about what constitutes judicial activism last episode, and the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision is, I think, the knockdown, no doubt about it, illustration of what judicial minimalism, of judicial small c conservatism, is all about.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, because it's a case, like you said, it's a case of conservative justices still upholding prior rulings and stare decisis, right? Without that bait and switch, I guess, except for that.
right.
But other than that.
So part two redefines our penumbra a little bit and tries to make it a bit more tethered. So instead of saying, you can find it somewhere, what the court says is, constitutional protection of the woman's decision to terminate her pregnancy derives from the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. It declares that no state shall, quote, deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The controlling word in the cases before us is liberty. And then it goes through. I'm not going to read all the citations. I'm not going to talk about the difference between substantive due process and procedural due process because we've done so much law geekery in this episode. But that's a good topic for another show if anyone cares.
Yeah, I'm actually starting to have seizures because of my blood is too full of law geekery. But yeah, go ahead.
We'll wait till you get through the bar exam. You know, they go on to say, the most familiar of the substantive liberties protected by the 14th Amendment are those recognized by the Bill of Rights. Then they talk about incorporation, which we talked about in our OA-21.
Second Amendment.
The first episode of the Second Amendment, exactly. And then it says, it is tempting as a means of curbing the discretion of federal judges to suppose that liberty encompasses no more than those rights already guaranteed to the individual against federal interference by the express provisions of the first 8 amendments to the Constitution. And then this is my favorite line. But of course, this court has never accepted that view. It is also tempting for the same reason to suppose that the Due Process Clause protects only those practices defined at the most specific level that were protected against government interference by other rules of law when the 14th Amendment was ratified. And then they cite to a Scalia opinion. But such a view would be inconsistent with our law. It is a promise of the Constitution that there is a realm of personal liberty which the government may not enter. We have vindicated this principle before. Marriage is nowhere mentioned in the Bill of Rights, and interracial marriage was illegal in most states in the 19th century, but the court was no doubt correct in finding it to be an aspect of liberty protected against state interference by the substantive component of the Due Process Clause in Loving versus Virginia, which we talked about in the first episode.
Right.
So that's a terrific, terrific smackdown of Scalia that this centrist court give. They say, look, like, you may want to define substantive due process as only protecting those rights that are expressly spelled out in the first 8 amendments to the Constitution, but the court has never taken that view. And you might say, you might have the view that Scalia has, and they specifically cite a Scalia dissent, that it's only protecting the kinds of rights that were recognized historically at the time that the 14th Amendment was passed, which is 1865.
This is a court that Scalia is a part of, right?
Yeah.
So these are just...
They are
three of the justices were like, gosh, I hate that guy. You know that Scalia guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't stand him.
Scalia has only been on the court.
Let's just totally embarrass him.
Yeah, go ahead. And that's what they're doing. That is literally what they're doing. Scalia has only been on the court for 5 years at this time. And this is senior.
Still hazing him.
Yeah, these are esteemed conservative jurists saying, get out of here with your crazy originalist ideas. We don't accept that.
Boy, those were the days.
Were the days. So that's the plurality opinion. They reaffirm the central holding of Roe. They change the trimester approach to the viability approach, which we will see in the next episode, what some of the implications of that are. And they reaffirm the central concept that the right to abortion is part of the notion of substantive due process, of these basic fundamental liberties that might not be spelled out in the Constitution, like the right to marriage, but are nevertheless part of the ordered concept of liberty that is inherent to a free society. And so in a situation where it looked like you might have a 7-2 majority to overturn Roe v. Wade, the go big or go home resulted in the anti-Roe forces going home. And that framework of Planned Parenthood versus Casey is what stands today. And in part two, I think we'll draw some parallels and talk about what does it mean for an upcoming Trump appointee on the Supreme Court or multiple Trump appointees on the Supreme Court.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Looking forward to part two. And by the way, patrons over at patreon.com/law, we should be able to make this one available early for you. Down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law. All right, time for Breaking Down the Law, everyone's favorite segment just because of the ridiculous intro.
That remains. There is never a point when I'm listening to our episodes that I do not smile when breaking down the law.
Well, you can smile and break down this for me. Class action lawsuits. Break it down.
Yeah. And class actions are an interesting vehicle. So it's kind of confusing because you can have multiple parties in a lawsuit, right? Even if it's just plaintiff versus defendant, you could have 20 plaintiffs versus 50 defendants, for example. And while that would be confusing, potentially confusing, that's not a class action. A class action is a special kind of lawsuit that you bring when identifying each and every member that belongs on a certain side of the equation is impracticable. Okay, that's the exact language that's used in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So let me give you a classic example, right? This is one of the most famous class action lawsuits of all time. It involved the Ford Pinto, which was an exceptionally cheap car that was produced in the late 1970s. And the Ford Pinto had a defect in its construction such that when hit from behind, the car would explode. Okay?
Yeah, it's probably not good. Not a good way.
Yeah, which is a bad thing. And what makes it a really famous case in tort law.
Wasn't it because they decided, or maybe this is what you're talking about, but isn't it because they decided that it wasn't worth the money to fix it? Like they would just deal with the legal costs rather than fix it?
That's exactly right. What happened was they discovered that there was this flaw. And then what Ford decided to do was instead of recalling the Pinto, they went to their accountants and said, okay, we want you to run up some numbers for us, right? And the first is what would it cost us to recall the Pinto and fix the defect? And then the second is, how often is this likely to, because it was not just every time it was hit from behind, it would blow up. Like there had to be a certain
amount of force or something.
Well, but also there had to be a certain sequence of events. Like it was not just every time you were hit from behind, you had to be hit from behind. Like when you were engaging into fourth gear. So I don't remember the precise precondition, right? But like it was a cascade of events. So it was an unlikely occurrence. And so what they said was, so first, run up the costs of a recall. And second, why don't you model the costs of how often do we think this is likely to happen? And what are we going to have to pay out in settlements for it when it blows up and people die? And so their accountants went to the actuarial tables and modeled it. And they came back with the following piece of advice, which I can give to you because this is not quite taking legal advice from a podcast. In your career, if someone ever asks you to model, can you model do the right thing versus pay off lots of lawsuits when people die? You might not want to do that work, right?
I feel like if someone asks you, if you're a god, say, yes.
Yeah. If someone asks you, is it cheaper for us to pay off lawsuits in settlements than to fix a problem that will murder children, you should maybe say no. No, it isn't.
Okay.
But as
this
it turned
is, this
out-
This is maybe, so you're saying this is the one time maybe take advice from this podcast. Yeah. This is not really not legal advice.
It's not more, legal advice. Yeah, right, this is just good common
clarification.
Sense. So they got this internal memo that said, yeah, you know what? It's going to be a lot more expensive to do the recall. And so Ford said, okay, cool. So we'll just pay off settlements whenever people blow up. And so as it happens in a civil lawsuit, you are entitled to discovery. And so the other side got access to all the internal memoranda, you know, to Ford's board of directors and about the Pinto. And eventually the document was turned over that showed this. And that was used as the basis for punitive damages because it was beyond we talked about the analogous sort of gross negligence standard, but you know it showed either gross negligence or specific intent to harm because they were given the option of
now does, so this. Does that mean they were personally liable, like it was that bad that those people
no
were
what it meant
liable,
what it was meant it was just... that Ford, in addition to paying the actual costs of having blown up children, had to pay punitive damages on top of
it.
Right. So that was the significance there. But all of that fun story about the Ford Pinto, that was a class action because if you think about it, who is your class of plaintiffs in that case, right? Like who's been harmed?
Does it count if it didn't happen to you? Is it just everybody who bought a Pinto that it might happen, or is it just people who?
It's just right. It's just people who bought the Pinto and it blew up, right? But if you want to prove it, remember Ford's model was based on taking these lawsuits one at a time and settling them out, right, and just paying people off. What you can do is aggregate all of the cases together and just prove it once, right? Which is what the plaintiffs did in that case, but it would not be practical to take several thousand people and you'd have to find them all, right? So what you do is you bring something as a class action. And when you bring something as a class action, this is governed by Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. You say, okay, there's one kind of injury. This is for plaintiffs. You can have class defendants. It's more rare, and I'm just not going to go into it in this segment.
Get into it later. Yeah.
Almost all class cases are plaintiff class cases. And what happens is you have one kind of injury and lots of people who suffer as a result of the injury. And so you say, we're just going to sue once. And you get named representatives of the class. And then there's a separate hearing. It's called a Rule 23 hearing, in which you decide if those representatives are appropriate to represent the class and will cover all of the interests of everybody in the class. So the way – and if they do, if they meet all the requirements of Federal Rule 23, then you go forward and instead of hearing testimony from 5,000 Ford Pinto victims, you hear testimony from three people who are the class representatives. So you can prove the case in kind of a more streamlined way, and then the verdict runs to the entire class with a couple little caveats that I'm about to explain. One of the things that's a challenge about class litigation is if people suffer from the single wrong in multiple ways, you could argue that the class representatives are not good representatives of, you know, kind of all of the members, right? So, for example, consider lead paint claims, right? Like, we know that ingesting lead paint can cause brain damage in very, very small children, right? But it affects different people differently, right? Like, it would affect, I don't know if you have an adult eating lead paint off his walls for some reason.
I do that.
It would affect the adult differently than it would affect a 7-year-old, differently than it would affect a toddler, differently than it would affect, you know, an infant. And so, you know, you would want to make sure that your class, the defendants would argue that if you just had your class representatives were adults now who ate paint as a kid, you would say, okay, but like that's not representative of the full class that you want them to represent. So there are a lot of complex issues with related to that. The real area in which you see a lot of class actions and which a lot of people are familiar are antitrust class actions, because those are situations where it's shown that a manufacturer of a product has been able to overcharge for a particular product. And then the class is really, really easy to determine because it's the class of everybody who bought that product, right? And they've all suffered, they've all engaged in exactly the same conduct, and they've all suffered exactly the same injury, right? So for example—
That's what I was asking you though. Like, I mean, I don't know how much the details matter, but was it just everyone who bought a Pinto, or did they have to have something actually happen to them?
Yeah, it was, the class was defined as, I believe it was defined as, I think there were multiple classes. There were people who suffered injuries and people who died as a result of the explosion, right? So you had to, it was the class of people who were in exploded Pintos. There was, I believe, subsequent litigation on behalf of all Pinto owners because, you know, once you're told, oh, by the way, your car has a certain risk of exploding, you would have certain consumer protection rights because, you know, you thought you were buying a car that was a non-exploding car. So that shows kind of another aspect of this where you can have subclasses of plaintiffs, but each subclass has to have a representative that represents that subclass, right? Okay. That suffered the same injury in the same way. And again, I'm alighting over a lot of the things. If our listeners are super interested, we can do a deeper dive on this. But I guess the real point on understanding class action versus individual is that the phrase gets thrown out a lot in movies, in public news, and that sort of thing. If you have everybody is actually present in the courtroom, right? Even if it's hundreds of people, then that's not a class action. A class action is on behalf of somebody.
So that's the key distinction. Yep. Is there a limit to how many you can have in a not class action lawsuit?
There's a practical limit, fitting people in the courtroom. But no, I mean,
I'm just wondering. No. So what I'm imagining is when all our listeners sue you because you got something wrong. I'm just wondering. If it's going to be individually. Because you never told them to not take legal advice from a podcast, I'm pretty sure.
I have said, don't take legal advice from a podcast.
I cannot wait until there's a lawsuit for this. If there ever is, I will say, hold on, let me go back, and I will get every time you've said that. I will make the whoever's suing you sit there and listen to 48 at consecutive hours of you saying, now remember, don't take live just forever. I can't wait.
You're cracking a joke, but that's exactly
what we would do.
That's exactly how I would begin my defense if that actually happened. Yeah. The reason that there's a trend towards aggregating together dozens of people, even hundreds of people, and naming them all individually is because in the past 30 years, there's been an increasing trend at the federal court level of courts deciding on that class representatives are not do not meet the requirements. They're not adequate. They're not typical. They're not representative of the class under the Rule 23 analysis. It's become harder and harder to prove, particularly in mass tort cases, of which the Ford Pinto is an example, right? Because, you know, if you think about it, right, when the car explodes, you know, everybody experiences that injury a little bit differently. And 30 years ago, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, courts were more flexible in saying, yeah, we get it. But, you know, the net result is a whole bunch of exploded kids. We're going to let you go forward. And today, in my experience, there is considerable
more scrutiny. About it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, so you get around that. You have to meet an additional hurdle to have your class certified. And you can get around that if you found every last person, you can get around. You name them all individually.
Oh, I got a question for you. Sorry to I was probably dragging on too long, but is a class action lawsuit by definition, does that have to be like a federal lawsuit because the people are everywhere, or does that not matter?
That's a really, really good question. You are bringing in our prior discussion on diversity jurisdiction in federal court. So yes, when you have complete diversity, right, which is to say that all of the plaintiffs and all of the defendants are in different states, that gets you into federal court.
Well, the defendant might be in one state, right? I mean, if you're just suing Ford or something,
right?
Are they
right. But what I mean by that's
but they're doing business.
Yeah, but what I mean by that is if Ford is a resident of Michigan, let's say, then you need to not have a Michigan plaintiff. Otherwise, if you have one Michigan plaintiff, that defeats complete diversity. All of your plaintiffs have to be from states other than Michigan in order to have diversity jurisdiction in federal court. So diversity means, right, because if you think about it in the one-on-one, right, that is you're from California, defendants from Michigan, you get into federal court to avoid the Homer problem. But if you have two plaintiffs and one's from California and one's from Michigan and the defendant is from Michigan, then you don't have complete you don't have complete diversity, and therefore you don't get diversity jurisdiction in federal court.
Right. So, but when it's a class action, you don't know who they all are. So that's why I was thinking.
And
do you just assume?
I mean, the answer is that it's a mechanism provided by in the federal rules. So you have to establish that you have a federal, you have a reason to be in federal court in the first place. Now, it's really, really easy to cross, you know, the minimum $75,000 rule in federal court. And it's really, really easy to get named plaintiffs who are outside the home jurisdiction of the person that you're suing. So it's easy to get into federal court that way. And then, you know, you abide by the procedures that were set forth in Rule 23.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Thanks for breaking that down.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. It's time to get back to it. Our favorite segment now. Thomas takes the bar exam. I am one for one. I got a perfect score. I'm sitting on a perfect score. I'm going for 200 for 200. I mean, I'm on easily on pace for that, right? I mean,
I put it
into the calculator.
I would be disappointed, actually, if you don't go 200 for 200.
Let's hear it. Question two.
All right.
I'm one for one. Here
Question
we go.
Question two. An inexperienced bicycle rider took her new bike for a test run.
I already love this question.
At an intersection, she could not stop for a red light and went into the intersection where she slipped off the bike. While attempting to remount it, a car coming into the intersection with a green light ran her over, causing severe injuries. The car driver was distracted by his cell phone and received a careless driving ticket from the police. The woman filed a claim for damages, asserting that the car driver was negligent per se. She claimed that a finding of negligence per se prevented the driver from asserting comparative negligence under a state statute. Will the trial court likely grant the woman's motion to preclude the man's attempted comparative negligence defense? And I should add...
hell, man?
So in most states, actually not the case in Maryland through a weird quirk, but in most states, this is a standard question of negligence, right? That is when you owe a duty to someone and you fail to exercise proper care. So driving through an intersection when you're distracted by your cell phone. That's outside the standard of care. And you run somebody over because the argument would be if you weren't distracted by your cell phone, you would have noticed a woman lying in the middle of the intersection. Uh-huh. So that's the negligence action. A comparative negligence defense says, okay, I may be negligent, but you have also contributed to this problem. And so we should weigh the amount of the negligence that you the plaintiff have contributed and reduce my liability by that percentage and contribute this comparative negligence defense replaced in most states an earlier doctrine called contributory negligence, which was just a binary question, right? So it used to be in many states you would say, you're negligent. And then the defendant would say, no, but you contributed to the negligence. And if you contributed to the negligence, then it was everybody gets to go free, right? So,
So this is all, we're already cheating because you're explaining too much.
Well, but I'm explaining.
That was in my, I just happened to read that in my review before
This is something, it's perfectly reasonable that you would know as a hotshot young would-be lawyer.
You were just explaining it to the listeners.
Right, exactly. Obviously you knew that.
Your speaking voice is better, so I just wanted you to explain it, not me.
Okay. So
what am I, did we get to the question?
So that's the question. The question is, will the trial court likely grant the woman, that's the accident victim, the plaintiff's motion to preclude the man, the defendant's attempted comparative negligence defense? Okay.
Okay. I think I
So he's going to raise comparative negligence. He's going to say, okay, whatever you prove.
We're both kind of negligent, right? Is he going he's trying to say we're both kind of negligent.
Right.
She's trying to say, no way. Right. That should your negligence should preclude any of mine.
Right. Because remember, she ran the red light.
Uh-huh.
So as with before, we have four answers. Answer A, yes, because the driver had the last clear chance to avoid the accident, which abrogates the comparative negligence law.
Mm.
B, yes, because negligence per se is a final judgment of total negligence against the driver, and it cannot be modified or rebutted.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did he get charged with negligence per se? I thought she was saying it would be negligence.
She's claimed that. There is no...
Claim that. He hasn't... Right. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Those are the two yes answers.
So that sounds like... So B so far sounds like nonsense to me, unless I'm missing something. Go ahead.
C... No, because the common law doctrine of negligence per se does not abrogate the defendant's right to apportion fault under the comparative negligence statute.
Hmm.
And D,
okay.
No, because she entered the intersection knowing it was a red light, thereby putting herself voluntarily and knowingly in danger, and she assumed the risk.
Can you read C one more time? That was a bit of a weird
one. No, because the common law doctrine of negligence per se does not abrogate the defendant's right to apportion fault under the comparative negligence statute.
So that's interesting. So that sounds like it would be sort of more of a technicality. Like that sounds like what she's even trying to assert wouldn't work even if it were true. So, I feel like this is a hard one. This is a really hard one. I feel like B was kind of nonsense. I think D was, can you read me D one more time?
D is no, because she entered the intersection knowing it was a red light, okay, thereby putting herself voluntarily and knowingly in danger. And she assumed the risk.
I feel like D can't be right. Maybe it's just because I'm in California and I feel like we're pretty hard on cell phones, but I just kind of feel like that trumps everything else. So I'm so for that reason, I was leaning toward an A answer, but the, sorry, an A or B answer. But the C answer is pretty tough because that is plain old law school knowledge that I don't have, I feel like. I think I'm going to go with A for this
okay.
one. Okay. I think I'm going to go with A.
All right. So you have answered A. We will find out if you are correct on next week's episode.
And maybe we'll find out how Chris Hansen relates to this particular law.
Please
as well.
Continue to play along. And the way in which you play along is, Thomas?
Make sure you follow at OpenArgs. That's our Twitter account, of course. And make sure you find the episode for the tweet for this episode and retweet and quote. And in your quote, you put your answer and a little bit of reasoning. And you can get creative. You can screenshot something if you wish. But you saw who won last time. That was pretty unbeatable. Maybe you'll be the next person to come up with one of those unbeatable answers. Still tons of support flooding in. We can't tell you how grateful we are. Going to be another Lot Awful Movies this month. You know what? I spilled the beans over on Atheistically Speaking. I don't know if you caught that, Andrew.
I did.
But we are planning on doing Miracle on 34th Street, a Christmas theme for this month's Lot Awful Movies. And that is, you don't want to miss that. That is a ton of fun. It's really funny. And I think a lot of people, I think these pledges are showing that they want to check out that bonus content. And they should, because it's really funny. And it's also informative too. So let's thank our new patrons. What do you think?
Awesome.
I want to thank Logan, Frank Aponte, Seth L., Travis Peterson, Sarah McLean, Shelley Liebman, Pumpkin Spice, Dan Hyman, Donovan, Morgan Mata, David, thank you, The Wayward Willis, thank you, Galaru, thank you, Starside, The Lawless One, Richard Stewart, Ben Wilcox, Austin Parks, Richard.
Thank you to Burglemer, to Kristen Mendez, Nicole, Jason Groutwell, Sarah Charlton, Jeffrey Smith, Mark Landis, Jaded Zappa, Adrian Parks, Larry McLaren, Sarah Ostermeyer, Terry Niemeyer, Joshua Mostite, Daniel Fox, and Malice Aforethought. Good name. Thanks to all of you new patrons for pledging over at patreon.com/law.
And of course, we've got to thank our Hall of Fame patrons. If you want to be a Hall of Fame patron, just simply pledge $5 or more over on patreon.com/law. And they are Roger Metcalf, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast. See, you get some, get your name out there too. Steve Sigmund, Jim Grove, Desecrator, Patrick Fussell, Amanda Lipnack, La Bibliotecatrice, Heather Loveridge, Leon Hartley, Geeker41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Allie, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall, John Bodley, Heath Enright, Jeffrey Maynor, The Wayward Willis, and Matthew Maxson, Detective Maxson.
And also thank you to Hunter Ash, Michael, Kylie Reiser, Jeff S., Sakashite Fukasumi, Propanic, Philip Stromberg, Michael Schaefer, Zabby, Frederick Alstromer, Sammy, Conrad Michaels, and our top patron, the Inciting Incident Podcast. Thank you all so much for being our Hall of Fame patrons.
Absolutely. All right. Look forward to part two on this, and not just part two on this abortion case. That'll be the answer to what everyone has been waiting for, the Thomas Takes the Bar Exam question two. And of course, we'll have another question in there for you. So all that early over on Patreon. Thanks for listening. Thanks for another great show, Andrew. And we'll see you next time.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.